was Ruby Ridge, and then Waco, Oklahoma City. We have this big crescendo building up, all these different events, building up to the first World Trade Center bombing, and was it 93? Supposed to knock over one of the two towers at least. And we worked our way up to TWA 800, got past that. I'm sure I've forgotten one or two, and then 9/11. And others. There have been many things. They've all been perpetrated by basically the same group. We have a rare opportunity through the good graces of Ole Damegaard, who is with us tonight, to hear something that you've never heard before about the Oklahoma City bombing. This is very interesting. It was really a pivotal event in many ways. Now, I'll never forget, you remember the axiom, the best and most accurate news usually and often comes within the first few hours of one of these big headline-grabbing events. And I remember hearing in Oklahoma City how the police were in that building, what was still left of it, and they were reporting live unexploded bombs located in the building, the Mura building. And they shut that down real quick. A lot of people died who were involved with that. One of the there was a black officer, a police officer involved. I've forgotten his name, but he was a hero. He stood very firm on what he saw and encountered there, and they killed him off. They do that all the time. Life means nothing to the controllers. Never forget that. We are very honored to have with us Mr. Cody Snodgrass, and he is standing by, I believe, right now. Are you there, Cody?
Yes, sir. I sure am. How are you doing?
Good. I've got a spelling on your last name. You want to spell it for me to make sure I have it correct?
Yeah, it's a strange name. It's S-N-O-D-G-R-E-S.
Snodgrass.
Yes, sir.
What is the derivation of that? What's it mean? Most names have some kind of a meaning.
Yeah, I don't know. It's kind of like, you know, Cary Snodgrass. That's the actor that most people know, and that's a G-R-A-S-S, and I really don't know.
It's, well, Snodgrass probably means truth teller in some dialect somewhere.
Well, that's what we're doing here tonight, that's for sure.
That's right. As we look back on Oklahoma City, on the OKC bombing, do you spend much time, I know you're doing a lot now, but during the years that have been intervening since then, did you spend much time tracking it, following it, or did you try to put it out of your consciousness as much as you could and get on with your life?
Well, no. It was something, when I was offered that job to bomb that building, I immediately was revulsed by it. I didn't want anything to do with it. Mm-hmm. And I told contractor that was there that did it, I just told him, you know, I'll just tell you the story. It was in October of 1994, and Harold Leonard, he's deceased now. Uh-huh. But I need to say something before we start.
Yeah, let's take it wherever you want. Go ahead.
Yeah, I always make a statement. In 1982, they had the Intelligence Identities Protection Act. That's the IIPA, and it's U.S. Code Title 50, Sections 421, 426. And it says the disclosure of a U.S. government operative's identity is illegal only if it is done intentionally and with knowledge that the government is still actively maintaining a cover for such operatives. So when we talk here, I'm not going to mention anybody's names still operational, but the people I'm talking about or will mention by name are dead. And so the reason
Understand.
I do that, if you recall that CI officer John Kiriakou, he was sentenced in January 2013 to 30 months in federal prison.
Mm-hmm.
And what he did was he violated this act, mm-hmm. the IIP Act, by disclosing an operative's name in that RDI program, the CI's Rendition, Detention, and Interrogation Program. So we don't want to do anything like that. We're just going to talk about people that are gone and dead and explain the story from there.
Very good. All right, what were you doing, minding your own business when this offer was made to you? Give me the background on that.
Yeah, I've been in Black Ops for a long time, almost 20 years. I was about to retire. In fact, I did retire in 1995 in March.
Can you name the company you were with? Which one?
I was an independent contractor in
Black
Hawk.
Very good.
One of my civilian covers, I was a petroleum geophysicist for Amoco Production Company.
Very good cover.
We were,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, it was a real good cover. But I was working on my master's degree in physics down in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And we got to fly the space shuttle simulator down there and all that stuff. But I went to Tulsa, Oklahoma and worked there in the early 80s. And then that was our cover for operations over in Arkansas when the Clintons were there and everything. But you fast forward through all those, and we're up to 1994 in October. And Harold Leonard called me one day, and he said, we have a job for you. We went out in the woods and get away from all surveillance and everything. And he said, we have a job for you. And I said, what country are we going to? I thought it was going to be in Saudi Arabia or something. And he said, no, it's here in the States. So I said, what kind of job is it? And he said, it's an EOD job. It's an explosives and demolitions job. And I said, what kind of op is it? And he said, it's a building. He said, it's a federal building. And I said, what? And I said, which one? And he said, the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building. And he had a backpack, purple and black backpack, that had $500,000 in cash in it. And he said, there's half here. We'll pay you half when the job's done. And you can have whatever you need, you know, to get it done. And I was getting towards the end of my career, and I had severe PTSD. And I'd actually died in the hospital twice back in September 18th through the 22nd in 1991 in Project Slammer. It was a covert program. But I was getting to the end of my career, and I couldn't take this stuff anymore. I was having bad dreams at night, and I just told him, I said, this is our own country, and I'm not going to do it. There's no way I'm going to do this. So I turned down that job, and that was a point at which I turned from an asset into a liability.
Immediately. Do you think he was wired, even though you went out in the middle of the woods?
No. I knew him for a long time. We've done several ops together.
Uh-huh.
But anyone that would be wired or had any kind of surveillance at all in that kind of op, they'd be killed instantly. We don't tolerate that kind of thing. He even went out under canopy, you know. They're worried about satellites reading your lips and stuff. I mean, these guys are, we're professionals, and we don't allow any kind of surveillance like that at all.
Wow. Satellites reading lips?
Yep.
And what decade was that begun in? 80s? 90s?
I don't know when it was begun, but the satellites have quite good capabilities.
That's extraordinary. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, let me get a quick comment from Ole at this point. Since you've been hearing this story, Ole, what kind of information has come to you? You've got a heck of a network of respect and people around the world. What's been the reaction that you're getting?
Is amazement, and also I can only say that I have not found anything at all that Cody has been lying about. Everything he said has been very accurate, sometimes very emotional, and I can just stand by his side. Not that I know for myself all the details, but what I can totally guarantee his serenity, or his how sincere he is and honest in his approach of getting the truth out there.
We are, if you just joined us, talking with Cody Snodgrass about the Oklahoma City bombing, a domestic terrorist alleged truck bombing on the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in downtown OKC. That was in 1995, April 19th. And it is a huge story that will forever be talked about and remembered here, no matter how many things continue to happen. And Cody was offered the job, as you just heard. All right, you said no. You turned from an asset to a liability, a long-term asset as well. From you saying you're getting close to the end of your career, and you just wanted nothing to do with it, because what was the overriding emotional response that said no to you? What was it?
It's patriotism. I mean, it was our own country, and it was our own people, and there's no way that I would do something like that. I mean, we did a lot of bad things in Black Ops, but that's what I told Harold. It's our own country, and I will not do it. I'm not going to do it. It was patriotic.
Okay, let me ask you a question about Black Ops in general. Deadly Black Ops in specific. What is it about the contractors, independent or on the company payroll, that allows them to knowingly, willfully kill men, women, and children? What is it about them? Are they psychopaths? Are they strictly business? What is it in the makeup or the constitution in people that can do that kind of work. I don't care what country we're talking about here. It's just taking human life.
Yeah, a lot of people are ex-military. That's what they're used on. They're ex-military cutouts. Some of them are in the military, mm-hmm. and then they get out, and they're free agents or free assets. Some people do it for money. Some people are, I guess, psychopaths. Some might do it for patriotic reasons.
Uh-huh.
There's a right. Each person has to come up with his own explanation and live with his own things that he does.
Right.
But there's a wide variety of reasons, and some of the things are just actually saving lives. I mean, if someone is about to detonate a suicide bomb in the Middle East somewhere, and you're a sniper doing overwatch, you would certainly kill that individual first before they had a chance to detonate that ordnance and cause all kinds of other secondary injuries.
Absolutely understood. Let me ask you another question. As these other terror events have occurred since OKC, and you've been able to, I guess we could say, just sit back and observe to a significant degree. Are you able to see through them pretty quickly, pretty well? When an event happens, like 9/11, all right, how long did it take you to get what happened there, to really get a sense of how it might have been pulled off? You probably had a pretty good instinct, I'm guessing.
Oh, yeah. I remember that day very, very clearly. I'd been at a guy's house, Captain Glenn Wilson. He did some work for the Defense Intelligence Agency, and he worked with Janet Reno down in Dade County, Florida. He did two tours in Nam, and I was down there at his house after he passed away, helping him clear out a machine gun collection. But I was driving up the pass in Colorado Springs there, coming back home, and I heard it on the news, and I immediately thought that I didn't believe the story at all, because I don't believe anything in the mainstream media here in America and mm-hmm. other countries. It's general propaganda for the most part. But I just immediately had the feeling that it was something more. And at that point, I hadn't gotten any actionable intelligence or talking to anyone about it. I was not involved in that operation. But mm-hmm. later on, after studying it, I think that they used nanothermites of other things, and they pre-wired those buildings, and then they used remote-controlled aircraft. I think those aircraft were like drones, and
I agree.
The whole thing was set up from WCT-7, and you probably saw it, Jeff, and I know Ole knows a lot about this. That Building 7 just pancaked straight down.
Sure.
Yeah.
It was tragically laughable to watch it go down and have people say that it was a result of the rest of the operation. No. And then when you understood that Giuliani's command and control center was in there and that was evacuated before, you got to start immediately questioning, well, what the hell's going on here? So they ran it out of WTC-7, then they blew up their command post so there would be no traces of the evidence of controlling the demolitions in the towers, which were apparently put together over the better part of a year. And I know William Rodriguez, he said that one floor, and I forget which tower he worked in, there was a whole floor on one of them, probably on both of them, that was shut off. The elevators wouldn't stop there, stairwells wouldn't open there, you couldn't go there. And yet the people above and below could hear things being moved around on the floor below or the floor above. And that's where they staged the explosives and the whole operation for each tower takedown. I think you've heard the same thing many times.
Right. And yeah, Ole, I'm sure he knows a lot more than I do about that 9/11 thing. That's just amazing, you know, with all the architects that signed the petitions. And the whole thing is, it's so obvious that it was a cover up. I mean, it's just obvious it was a false flag.
Yeah. And I agree completely with the RC remote control aircraft used for sure. The planes with people in them were taken to a specific location. I just got a note today from somebody about this one Mossad agent on one of the flights, Daniel Lewin, and I couldn't imagine if in fact all the passengers were, let's say, nerve gassed in those planes and killed and then taken out and just dumped. But Lewin, they wouldn't sacrifice one of their own. And I've got word today from somebody that Lewin still has two active email accounts. So there you go. Just got that a few hours ago, and I thank the person who sent it to me. So, yeah, all complicated, very sophisticated. Go ahead, Ollie.
No, I just wanted to say that some years ago, my daughter, she was about 6 or 7, I was studying 9/11, and she came and asked me, what are you doing? And I said, well, I told the official story. And she looked at me and she said, Dad, I'm a child, I'm not stupid. But that's the official story.
Oh, that's wow. Well, there's a Damagard for you. Got it in the jeans. That's very nice. Well, you should be proud.
Before your mind is messed around with enough so that you believe this type of crap, there's just this normal, what I call Farmer Brown logic. I mean, you cannot dustify a building that size with just a plane.
Well, that's the correct word, too. The building was dustified. One other question on 9/11, then we'll jump off and get back on the main topic. Cody, there is a lot of talk about thermite, nanothermite, and all that. Clearly, there were explosions going off all the way down the sides of those buildings. You can see them if you go slow-mo. Even if you don't, you can still see them. What about shaped nukes to core out the 13 columns in the center? That makes sense. Does that work for you? Small shaped nuclear charges to further dustify the internal structure?
Well, that could have certainly been one modus operandi to pull that off. I have an appendix to this book that we've written. It's Choosing the Light, Dark Secrets of the Oklahoma City Bombing. But we briefly discussed the 9/11 thing, and I got a copy of a report from Europe where one of the workers had, at 9/11, it was charged with cleaning up, had actually taken some of the molten metal secretly, and he had sent it to some physicists overseas, and they ran the standard X-ray diffraction and gas chromatography, mass spectrometry, and all that high-powered stuff on it, and they found evidence of nanothermite there.
Uh-huh.
And so the nanothermite, what it does is it has a real hot burning characteristic.
Right.
And so if you use a combination of nanothermite with the heat combined with a very sharp, fast explosion like C4, which is has a detonation rate of approximately 26,000 feet per second. That
wow.
combination would be enough to sever those main beams, because those twin towers were built to withstand multiple impacts from jetliners.
Yes.
And those,
yes.
You know, Jeff, those big main columns in there, those things were huge.
Yeah.
And now nukes could do that, tamped nukes, that certainly could happen, but there'd be the telltale radiation signs later. And if you're going to pull a covert op, what you want to do is minimize blowback. So,
You don't want radiation laying around to be read. I did have people, though, tell me that there were readings, aberrant readings at Ground Zero days and weeks later. And then you had the issue of the melted cars a couple of blocks away, which at 26,000 feet per second, that's a huge flash of intense heat. I mean, there it could be right there. You might not need nukes for that. That's an extraordinary rate of explosivity.
Yeah, that's standard C4, and then they use composition B, which is another less one. And like in the Ryder truck that McVeigh supposedly used with the ammonium nitrate and diesel, each explosive that you use has a characteristic waveform, and it's called a spherical wave divergence. And some of them, the compression waves are not, in the case of diesel or composition B, those compression waves are not sufficient to cut steel. Only the high, fast explosive rates like C4, that's the only thing combined with nanothermite that would actually cut those very big steel beams.
Yeah, well, they were cut like wet noodles, apparently. Okay, let's get right back to our special guest, independent black ops contractor Cody Snodgrass, who has retired, was at it a long time, and knows a lot of different things. And what we have is a story that may sound implausible to some of you, but in this day and age, not much does anymore. Cody was offered $1 million to blow the Alfred P. Murrah Building in Oklahoma City. And this was done, if you didn't hear it, out in the middle of a forest or a wooded area. The offer was made. Somebody had a backpack with $500,000 cash. The other $500,000 was due on completion of the job. And Cody said, no, no thank you. And that turned him into an immediate liability. And we know that the intel people don't like liabilities. So what happened next, Cody?
After I turned that job down, there was about six more months. And by 1995, in March, I had my retirement party. And I made up my mind I'd never go back to that kind of stuff. And
right.
I wanted to kind of turn my life around and get back to the light more. And so then in April 19th, 1995, the building went off. And when it did, I immediately went black, so to speak. We had false IDs and, disguises and so forth. And we had a network. I used to be a geophysicist for Amoco Production Company in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. But we were running black ops over in Arkansas in the early 80s, 82, 83, 84, 85. One of the ops was Centaur Rose, was the code name, Rose for the Rose Law Firm.
Oh, I was going to ask you if this had anything to do with Clinton's or Rose. Well,
yeah, it did. There were three ops there. Centaur Rose and Jade Bridge and Screwworm. And back in 84, Congress had passed the Boland Amendment after Senator Boland, and which forbade us to be militarily involved down in the conflict in Nicaragua, where the Soviets were supplying the Sandinista communists there with Daniel Ortega, who was the president. And, of course, we were supporting the Contras. So President Ronald Reagan at the time, he wanted to keep the balance of power there. And he secretly ordered CIA director to conduct those operations to arm the Contras and keep the Soviets from taking over the rest of Central America. So,
and that's that was the goal, by the way, for those of you listening. The Soviets were after all of Central America. They wanted the whole thing.
Oh, yeah. And so, anyway, they had the ops there in Arkansas when Bill Clinton was governor. And the Centaur Rose op was the one where arms were taken down there to covertly arm the Contras, and then the drugs were brought back, cocaine, to pay for the op, because they could, this was an illegal domestic op, and they couldn't go to Congress for money, so that's how they funded it. In the meanwhile, I was a geophysicist over there, and we were working in that op, and we had a network of, safe houses and so forth there, and the guys I was working with had worked for the CIA in the Vietnam War, and so anyway, after the Murrah Building went off, I went down there to our series of safe houses, and I hid out for a while. I was afraid they were going to kill me because I knew about the op and turned it down, and I was a liability.
Cody, a question, please. Excuse me for the interruption.
No,
the safe houses couldn't have been run by the people who would have tried to kill you. Who put these safe houses? I don't want names, but I mean, in general, how did these safe houses come to be, and were they actually safe from the black ops machines that you were worried about?
These guys were really good for Vietnam. They'd been in a lot of ops over there, and then they came back to the States, and they were working in the ops over in Arkansas. The safe houses consisted of farms, and one had an airstrip.
So they set them up independently of the government or the intel agency community, all that. They needed their own place to go. So like a group did this for their own self-protection.
Well, sure. Any time you're running a black op, the less knowledge about anything, the better.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of black operators don't even trust anybody. I mean, if they're on a sanctioned CIA op, a lot of times they won't trust any of the own guys that are with them, because there's always intelligence leaks, things can happen. So they always set up things for themselves, usually, that no one knows about, no one can trace. And it's a safe house. It's a place where you can go and be safe from all the long reach of the black community.
Got it. Very good. Well, you answered the question perfectly. Thank you for that. Okay, so you went to ground. You went to safe house after the Murrah blast. You knew there were going to be trouble. How long did you have to hang out?
Oh, well, I actually left the country after that for a while. We had false passports and stuff, and I stayed here in Oklahoma for a number of months, and then mm-hmm. I disappeared for a while, and then came back up to the States later after things had cooled off. By that time, they had indicted Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols for the bombing. They were actually the patsies.
They had their patsies. Yeah, okay. Gotcha.
Yeah, like you said before, the bomb, the building was pre-wired. And those bombs were there already installed and by another black ops team. And mm-hmm. McVeigh was the patsy with the Ryder truck. And when
right.
he was going to pull up at about 9 a.m. on April 19th, 1995, he was going to detonate that bomb, and that was the cover for the op. In other words, Jeff, when an op like that goes off, it's going to be very public. There's going to be a lot of press, a lot of firefighters and people. And so when you have a very public op like that, you have to have a cover for that op. And the cover was the Ryder truck that was going to detonate and be the patsy and the lone bomber to cover up the fact that that building, they were going to be detonated simultaneously. But what happened, two of the bombs didn't go off. And that black police officer you're talking about, you couldn't remember his name earlier, his name was Randy Yeeke, and he had been a MP before in the military.
That's right. Yeah.
And he got out and was working for the Oklahoma City Police Department. And he was actually the first responder. He was down on Northwest 5th Street in downtown Oklahoma City in his patrol car, and he'd stopped someone on a regular traffic stop, was given a ticket, and when that bomb went off about 9:02, 9:03 a.m., and then he went running, and he was the first one in that building, and, with the glass and all of the lacerations and stuff, there was a lot of people, a lot of stuff going on, and he rescued four people that were bleeding, and
right.
he won the Oklahoma City Police Department's Meritorious Conduct Award for saving civilians. And then during the course of that, he went in a daycare center trying to find some children and help them, and he discovered those unexploded bombs, one of them. And so they didn't detonate all the way, and so now they had another cover-up they had to do.
Yeah, now that's a very interesting thing. Thank you for bringing that out. I heard that early on, and that story disappeared real fast. So he saw the bomb. I wonder where the bombs were placed in near the nursery, probably in the debris and the wreckage he could see around corners or through false walls that he shouldn't otherwise be able to see through. He must have known what he was looking for.
Well, yeah, he'd been in the military, and when he saw that unexploded bomb in the daycare, he immediately began to know that there was something fishy going on.
Oh, yeah.
And when you're doing any kind of terrorist that do operations and blow buildings and stuff, they always consider the psyops, the psychological effect on the civilian population in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And so the daycare bomb, if it didn't have any structural reason to be there, like the beams in the building, the main reason to put the bomb in daycare is because they wanted children casually so that they could use the emotional appeal. That's what terrorists do. They try to cause maximum carnage and maximum damage to get the biggest emotional response. I mean, it's a horrendous thing, but that's how these satanic people think.
The black police officer in the nursery, and the idea was that nursery was supposed to be obliterated and all the children gone, just wiped out. Was the entire building supposed to drop? Was that supposed to be part of the game?
Yes, absolutely. There were three main charges. They were all supposed to detonate simultaneously at the same time that Timothy McVeigh was going to set off that Ryder truck.
Right.
But McVeigh didn't know that those black operators in there, they had two ops. He was supposed to pull up there and do that, and then the guys on the inside had their own thing. And McVeigh was the cover. He was the patsy. When they offered me that job, I immediately knew it was a patsy job, because $1 million, I wouldn't even consider doing an operation like that for that kind of money. That's ridiculous. And I knew it was Apache, and I was fixing to retire, so they killed two birds with one stone.
Oh, so you got you figured out that you were being set up for a potential Patsy at that low of a price.
Absolutely. I knew it was a Patsy job right off the bat, and then I was fixing to retire in a few months, and that way they killed two birds with one stone, and they shut me up, and I'm the Patsy, and I'm no longer a liability. And so anyway, Randy Yeeke found that bomb, and he began his own investigation. And over the years, he interviewed a lot of witnesses and talked to a lot of people, and he collected about 9 file boxes of various forms of evidence about that. And he was warned off by his commanders in the Oklahoma City Police Department to not pursue this. The FBI offered him a cush job in Dallas to stop what he was doing. And he was a patriot, like me. And, eventually, Randy Yeeke, he fell into quite disfavor, and they just flat out threatened him and said, you need to stop this stuff. And he had another friend that he made copies with of those records. And, he was getting scared towards the end. And, they took another copy of the records and they put them in a, safe deposit box in one of the banks downtown there. And so one day, he told his wife, Tanya, he said, I'm going to take all this stuff out of here. I'm getting nervous. And he went up to Kingfisher, Oklahoma, and, he had them in his patrol car, and then he was going to put them in a storage room. A little while later, after he had lunch there, this was on May the 8th of 1996, there was a patrolman. He was a Canadian County deputy sheriff. His name was Mike Ramsey. And he was out driving around doing his normal driving around one of the prisons up there, you know, checking for inmates and stuff. And he found Yankee's car sitting out there by a field. And the trunk was open. The door was open. And he pulled up on it. And it was covered with blood. He called it all in. About 40 or so law enforcement officers all descended on the area. There was State Highway Patrol, Oklahoma Bureau of Investigation, Canadian County deputies. They all looked, and they found Randy Yeeke's body. He was quite a ways from the car, and he had been cut up. He had multiple cuts all over him, contusions. He had been beaten, and he'd also been shot in the back of the head. And so they looked around for his service revolver. His pistol was gone, and they looked for it and couldn't find it. And so after close to an hour of all these police officers wandering around trying to find the gun, I mean, there was a gunshot to the head, then a black helicopter came out of the FBI office in Oklahoma City, and in that chopper was the FBI's SAC. That's the Strategic Area Commander. His name was Bob Rick, and there was a couple other guys with him in that chopper. And when they were there for about 5 or 10 minutes, all of a sudden they found the gun. After 40 or more trained police officers had looked for almost an
hour. Got it. Yeah, I understand. Gotcha.
Okay. So Yeeke had died. And then the guy that he had given the other copy of the files to, his name, I believe, was Ron. I've got it in the book. I got all the details in this book.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it was Dr. Don Chumley. That was his name. Anyway, he had a single-engine civilian aircraft, and he was taking those files somewhere to put them up, and his plane crashed exactly the same day on May the 8th, 1996. So Tanya Yeeke, his wife, was the only one that knew where the other files were in the safety deposit box.
Uh-huh.
And by then, the police had called her and told her husband was found dead. So she went down to the bank building to retrieve the files. And the woman there told her that the FBI had just been there and taken those files under national security. These were all of Randy Yeeke's records that he'd been. He was the one that first saw that bomb there. He was the first responder. And he got real suspicious. He knew there was a cover-up, so he started trying to document it. And now all the records, everything, vanished into the black hole.
Well, we must honor Randy, and I'm glad you were able to fill in all those blanks. Another great American sacrificed. I'm sorry to hear it. Is his wife still alive?
Well, what happened to Tanya after that, she realized that there was something big going on. And when she got back home, someone had broken her house and they had wrote some threatening things on the wall. I can't remember. It's in the book exactly what it was.
Right.
Something like, you know, you're next or something. And so she went to stay with her sister, And then a couple of weeks later, her car, she was driving it, and the brakes failed on it. And she was doing about 40 miles an hour, and she managed to get it under control. And they took it into a shop there, a local shop, and they had it inspected.
Uh-huh.
And they said that someone had tampered with the brake lines.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. All right. Same old. They just kill off everybody who's a liability, as you said in the very beginning.
Well, that's, Jeff, that's how they do on a standard black op. If they call it blowback.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a true black op stays only the black operators that do it and the principals that hire it out, they're the ones that know about it. But if something sours up, like in the Murr building, that the two bombs did not explode, and so now you have a bunch of blowback and you have to start covering it up, and that's what they did with the witness. They control the blowback.
Okay, and welcome back. Talking with Cody about the Oklahoma City bombing. We've covered a very important aspect of it already, and that was the heroic effort of a black police officer to document the entire crime as much as he could, and there was a lot there. Again, to say it a third time, I'll never forget the initial reports. Being a journalist, I heard these things, Cody, and I said, wait a minute. Officers don't make mistakes. Emergency personnel don't make mistakes. If they saw bombs in there, there were bombs in there. And then we never heard another word about it, and I figured, all right, well, cover up. It's all covered up. It's gone. We'll never hear it again. And we didn't. So, okay, we got a Patsy. We got a Ryder truck. We have a seismograph, which I think showed two different detonations, if I remember correctly. How do you go about trying to coordinate the detonation in a truck allegedly perpetrated by one crew and then the group in the building or the group adjacent to the building with the remote controlled detonations? How does that work?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jeff. It's logistical. But I just wanted to say something about that cover-up, you know, you were just talking about.
Yeah,
there was a massive cover-up, and one of the reasons the Oklahoma City Police Department covered up Randy Yeake and helped the FBI was because the FBI had been conducting undercover investigations into there were some of the officers inside the Oklahoma City Police Department prior to the bombing that had been dealing drugs. And the FBI had evidence on them. And so when the FBI needed help, you know, covering up this thing and putting out the cover story that McVeigh was a lone bomber, they leaned on the Oklahoma City Police Department, told them, look, if you don't cooperate with us and help us squash down this investigation and make all this stuff go away into a black hole, then we'll indict your people for drug dealing. So it was actually a blackmail thing.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. The tarnished image of the FBI, all I can say from my position is pretty damn well deserved.
Oh, yeah. And so when to get back to the original question, Jeff, about that
coordination,
that coordination, that could be done fairly simply. They probably had some visual person down the road somewhere in one of those bank buildings or the OG&E building, the Oklahoma Gas and Electric building surrounding that. And when McVeigh came, because you can't really tell about traffic, if you're going to have a bomber come up in a truck, he might get stopped by, red light or any number of things. And so he was supposed to be there right around 9, and I think that bomb actually detonated at 9:03 a.m. that day. And there were those two seismographs. Just like you said, that's a great point because it helps with the forensic analysis of uncovering this crime. But when they probably had a visual guy, and he would be on a radio, probably on an encrypted frequency.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would say, okay, here's they're pulling up and they're fixing to get out, and they could time it that way. Or there's other ways they could do it, but it was timed pretty close. But the main problem they had is that the two other bombs did not detonate, and now the feds had to go in there and cut and remove those bombs. Plus the main reasons, the real reasons why they actually ordered that bombing op in the first place. It's pretty astounding stuff. Now they had to go in there, not only remove those bombs and hide them from everybody, but they had to get rid of what they originally wanted to destroy in that blast.
That's why we had reports of people carrying a lot of stuff out of the building.
Yes.
And I remember.
Yeah. And this is a good stuff, and if I can tell you the real reasons why they bombed that building, if you'd like.
I would like, yes. One question first. How dangerous is it to go in there and try to take out two unexploded bombs like that?
Well, that's a good question, too, but it depends on, of course, the type of ordnance that's used and the type of detonators that's used. They could be any number of types, but depending on what that is and the types of detonators, then, and also the time factor, you got to remember, they wanted very few people to see those two bombs, so they had to get them out quickly.
Oh, yeah.
And, so they probably, if they were used with a standard M7 DuPont electric blasting caps, which is a common EOD tool, they take 3.2 volts to detonate those, so they're set up on a DC supply somewhere, and they probably just cut there's two lead wires that go into them.
Real simple.
And, they stay shunted normally to prevent RF exposure. That's radio frequency stuff. So when they're operational and are unshunted and they're hooked up to the power source, all you'd have to do is turn the power source off or cut the lines, basically.
Got it. All right. Very good. All right. Why the bombing? Why did they level the building? Why did they try to level the building?
Okay. I have to go back through just a little bit of history so the listeners can understand, because this is very, very important to our country. So if you go back to January of 1991, that was the Gulf War. And previous to that war, Saddam Hussein, he was a CIA asset. He had been engaged in a war with Iran, and Iran had enjoyed a 10-to-1 infantry advantage, and we were always worried about the Iranians overrunning our asset, Saddam.
Uh-huh.
And so we secretly, covertly, in the Reagan administration, we armed Saddam with the Ames strain of anthrax, and that came out of Fort Detrick, Maryland. It had a small protein coat. It had a small spore size and a different protein coat. It's a weaponized version of anthrax, which would be more readily absorbed. And so we gave them that covertly. And he never used it. And so when he invaded Kuwait, we had to demonize him and stop him. The Saudis were putting a lot of pressure on us. So we went in there in Desert Storm and went to remove him from Kuwait. And our Pentagon, they were all afraid that he would use that AIM strain of anthrax on our own troops.
Oh, yeah.
This, I'm going to try to go through this, and it's just a little background. We'll get to the
This is fascinating.
Here.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so anyway, so they didn't want to admit to the American people they'd given him this stuff. And now that we were going in there, they had to come up with a vaccine of our troops. It's normally a 6-month injection, course of injections where you take one shot per month. And we didn't have time to wait 6 months.
Oh my God. I know where you're going.
They created a new vaccine that that went 1 month, and they got Bioport and some of these other companies to make it. They waived FDA approval. They hurried our troops through there. They gave them these shots. The first lot went to Dover Air Force Base. The pilots were all getting sick. This new thing had squalene in it. It's an adjunct. It's an autoimmune booster, very similar to the Therasol, which is a mercury-based thing in flu shots, or the aluminum, yeah.
I remember when squalene was identified as an adjuvant, a booster, and I'd never heard of it before. And now... Wow, this is mind-boggling what you're telling us, Cody. Go ahead, please. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so now they gave this new vaccine to our troops. It was untested, and it led to what was generally called the Gulf War Syndrome. People were getting sick.
Yeah.
Nobody knew why. And then the second thing that happened in that war, that was the very first time our military had ever used depleted uranium weapons in a war. And we expended approximately 200 tons of it, primarily in the A-10 Warthog tank buster jets that use a 30-millimeter chain guns.
Uh-huh.
And they used depleted uranium-238. And then our M1 A-1 Abrams tanks, which, by the way, Tim McVeigh was a tank commander in Desert Storm. He won a Bronze Star for confirmed kills.
Mm-hmm.
But those M1 A-1 Abrams tanks had sabot rounds in them. And they had about an 8 or 9-inch rod of depleted uranium-238 inside of them. And they had a very high kinetic energy, about 5,200 feet per second. So when those rounds hit Soviet tanks, they had enough kinetic energy to blow an 11-ton turret just clean off. Saddam was using those T-54 Soviet tanks. So anyway, there was a big explosion, and a brand new thing happened that had never happened in war before. And this depleted uranium cloud, this explosion was forming new compounds like uranium dioxide. And so when these particulates settled down, the micron size of them were 4 millimeters. Now, our standard military mop gear, the filters on them only went down to 10 microns. So our troops began breathing this low-level radioactive particulates, and they went through the filters, and they accumulate in the human body in two basic places, in the thyroid glands and in the ovaries if you're a woman, or the testicles if you're a man.
Oh, my God.
Now, when our troops started coming back from Desert Storm,
mm-hmm.
they were sick from the squalene adjuncts in these new experimental anthrax vaccines, and they were also carrying inside of them low levels of depleted uranium. Now, what do soldiers do when they get back home? You know, they see their wives and they make love and have children. And what the Pentagon was worried about, this is the first time this ever happened, the semen in the men had radiation in them, and they were being transferred into mm-hmm. the women.
Sure.
They were getting sick. The children were getting sick and mm-hmm. having failure to thrive syndrome is what the Air Force called it. And the Pentagon, Jeff, they didn't know how many generations this sickness was going to be transferred. And so they potentially had on their hand hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars of long-range medical bills. And so a few years after the war, 1994, there was Chris Shays. He was a senator on an Armed Services Committee from Connecticut, Republican, and he was tasked with determining medical culpability for the Gulf War syndrome of all our troops. We had approximately 480 troops and all the branches of service coming back, and a lot of them were sick. And as I know, Jeff, you've heard about that Agent Orange thing, you know,
sure.
from Vietnam.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
And the big DuPont settlement. Well,
yep. Yep.
This was something potentially bigger. And so Senator Shays said, we need to determine medical culpability, and we're going to request the FBI to gather all the records of these people so we'll have medical files and we can give them money. Well, guess where the medical files were stored?
Oh, no. Oh, this is sickening. God.
In the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building. Now, I know that. See? Now, I got one more bombshell here. So let's just think about that for a minute. I mean, think about what's going on here. It's a Pentagon cover-up. The mop gear was defective. Our troops got sick from that depleted uranium.
Cody, that was a nuclear war. They were exposed to radiation. They were radioactively tainted, poisoned. They came back and gave birth to deformed kids, poisoned their wives. The whole families got sick. This is unbelievable.
Yeah, they called it Gulf War Syndrome. They laid it off on Saddam burning, you know, he lit those oil wells in Kuwait on fire and all this other
stuff. Well, we supposedly blew up some of his chem weapons dumps, too. It's all crap. This is a combination of depleted uranium, radioactive weapons, and the squalene as an adjuvant in the vaccine, among other things. So you got a vaccine component, and you got depleted uranium as the other component, and you got hundreds of thousands of sick and dying veterans.
Right. And so when all those medical records went away, okay, in the Murrah building blast.
Yeah.
Now that, okay, So there was a hearing later on in September the 19th of 1996. This was a congressional hearing on Gulf War Syndrome after the Murrah Building records had been lost. And at that hearing, the DOD admitted under oath, you know, at the hearing that over 400,000 Gulf War Syndrome records of our veterans had, quote, disappeared. So without the record, they didn't give out the money. Meanwhile, our guys were getting sick. Now, you want to hear the second reason why the Murrah Building was blown up?
That's bad enough. Go ahead. Jesus.
Yeah, well, that's what happened. That's why they ordered that up. The second one has to do with corruption of Mr. Clinton, Bill Clinton, and Hillary Clinton. And this went back to Centaur Rose and Jade Bridge and Screwworm. They were three multiply nested ops in Arkansas back in 82, 83, 84, 85. And to make a long story short, we were arming the Nicaraguans with a lot of weapons. And Barry Seal was a contract pilot for CIA. He had been in the 20th Special Forces Group back in Fort Benning in 63, took his training, went to Vietnam as a pilot, came back, and accepted, you know, CIA ops in Arkansas. And he was running the MENA airport there with a front company called Rich Mountain Aviation. And so they were all bringing the cocaine back to pay for this. And they were running approximately $100 million a month in coke through there. And my sources told me that Bill Clinton and them were getting about $10 million a month, 10% of the op money. And he later used that money to go run for president. But anyway, there had been a large contingent of law enforcement agencies that had gotten wind of the CIA covert operations there in around MENA. And the Arkansas Bureau of Investigation, the state police, the DEA, the IRS, they were laundering this money through the banks in Little Rock and the Worthington Bank in Atlanta, which was sent overseas to the Caymans at a bank called the BCCI. That's a Bank of Commerce and Credit.
Oh, yeah, BCCI. Oh, I know. I remember that.
Yeah. And so, yeah, all this ties into this stuff all later on. But anyway, to make a long story short, they had a lot of law enforcement records there, okay? And they were all being stored in the FBI office in Little Rock. Prior to the Murrah Building bombing, there was a police detective in Tulsa, where I used to work, named Craig Roberts. And he got a call from an FBI agent who would not give his name. And he told him that all those law enforcement records had just been moved to the Murrah Building. And so when it blew up, Jeff, okay, all those records that could have been used to indict Bill and Hillary Clinton, they were all gone. And you remember in July 26th of 1994, that's when the Whitewater investigation began. And then in August of 1994, that's when Ken Starr, you remember him?
Sure do.
He was appointed to the as the Whitewater prosecutor to replace that Fisk that Janet Reno had appointed. See, Clinton had got Janet Reno as U.S. attorney, and then they appointed Fisk to help cover all this Whitewater stuff up.
Yeah.
And that's why they put Ken Starr in there, because they knew the investigation had been rigged. So this whole thing gets real deep. And we have a lot of detail in the book that ties all this stuff
all right,
together.
Let me, first of all, Ken Starr was a disappointment, was he not? He wasn't able to do what everyone hoped he would.
Right.
Now, and then secondly, let's give I want to get the title that we've tried to find. Where is the book available, Cody? I've got to give that information out.
Yeah, I just have to explain, Jeff, this book is different from a lot of books. Most people that write a book, they go to a publisher, they get it published, and then they go out and start doing interviews.
Yeah.
Since this book was about black ops and I was afraid about writing and exposing things, I had to do everything the opposite. I couldn't approach a publisher with this because I was afraid they'd rat me out to the CIA and then they'd shut the whole thing down. So what we have to do is interviews first, the book later. What we have now is CD copies, edit copies, and we're under negotiation with several publishers for the rights to the book. But we do have some available through my website for people who want
this book. Please give that information out now, because I know a lot of people listening. I urge all of you. I'll tell you right now, this is without question one of the most important books of my professional career I have ever come across. And he said this goes deep. This goes as deep as you want it to go. This really exposes the whole horror of the Clintons, the Gulf War, Saddam Hussein. My God, the depleted, I was on the depleted uranium story very early on, Cody. And now you have made it eminently clear that our young men and women were just tossed to the breeze. No one cared. They didn't care.
Yeah.
God, they were sacrificed. And how many have committed suicide? 20 a day are still committing suicide, I understand, something like that.
Yeah, there's approximately 22 a day, and we work here with veterans, and we don't charge money. We help them with their PTSD and so forth, and so a lot of them are sick and suffering, and the VA just basically, switched it all under the rug, and it's a real sad thing. But I'll give out my
please.
Let's see, I'm gonna give out my email.
Okay.
And people can contact me there. We'll tell them how to get the book there.
All right.
My email is Cody. Cody.
Yeah.
Golden. Gold. E-N,
mm-hmm.
Elk, E-L-K,
mm-hmm.
@yahoo.com.
Got it.
Cody Golden Elk. I'm part Cherokee Indian, and that's my Indian name, is Cody Golden Elk.
That's a great name.
Yeah.
It is. I've got it. We're going to go through the break here at the bottom of the hour. Thank you, sponsors. This is far too important. We've got to get more and as much as we can in this hour out for everyone. And the more that Cody is able to present this, the safer he gets. Obviously, I don't have to tell you listening that he is really treading on thin ice, super thin ice with this, and taking a great risk. But he's obviously a great American. And all right, I'm going to back up just a little bit. Depleted uranium. I can't tell you how many programs I did on that, trying to find out the wherewithal and how it worked and all the rest of it. We knew that when the rounds with the kinetic rounds hit the tanks or the armor, whatever they were being shot at, we knew that they were actually, when they came out of the barrel of our tanks, they were supposedly burning already. They were that hot. They hit, they impact, they explode into uncountable nanoparticulates, radioactive particulates. They went everywhere. Everybody was breathing it. There was no way to get away from any of it. You were breathing your death when you were over there. That stuff went everywhere. It ended up on the ground in the sand, and whenever the wind blows, it blew it. It blew it up in the air again. It's still there. It's still polluted. What can these people do who have been contaminated, who are dying right now? They're still radioactive. This stuff doesn't go away. That's not the way it works. I've got one product. This is not a sales pitch. This is a product that I have. It's called Bio Superfood. It was created by Dr. Michael Kuryak, is a Russian scientist after Chernobyl. And he found that by combining the four most potent algaes that he could find on the world surface, on the face of the earth, into one compound, Bio Superfood, it actually not only nutritionally was fabulous, but it chelated the radioactivity out of the bodies of Chernobyl victims at a remarkable rate. And he saved lots and lots of lives with that. So that's one thing. But in that the government would never even admit that these people had been dosed with radioactivity, what could the VA do, even if it wanted to, without assuming liability and exposing the government to full liability for turning our men and women into radioactive sacrifices? This is what they did.
Right. The problem is actually much bigger than that. I've got multiple degrees in mathematics and physics and stuff like that, and I can get pretty technical with all this, but just in layman's terms, one of the secondary part of this was that, as you said, those nanoparticulates, they were deposited in the area wherever these battles were, and then later on, our troops might go through that same area.
Right.
On a different operation, and the half tracks on the tanks and the choppers would stir this dust back up. And these guys, a lot of times weren't wearing their mop gear, and they're breathing this stuff straight in. And then the other part of it, they had a cover up with the United Nations, because this stuff was all getting into the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. And those rivers were used to irrigate the date crops in Iraq. One of their biggest exports, they have like 20 some odd, I think it's 26 kinds of dates that they export around the area. Those dates were beginning to pick up this radioactivity. And then about 10 years after the Desert Storm in 91, right around 2001, when the Twin Towers came down, these UN reports came out. And there was a 600% increase in leukemia-type sicknesses in the children in Iraq. So it wasn't just our soldiers. It was the people there and the suffering of those children there. So
it wasn't just overdosed, hyperdosed Fallujah. It was into the ground, into the irrigation water, into the agrarian crop. In this case, it's dates and other crops as well. So we literally destroyed the whole country.
Oh, it's not only that. We had also sold Saddam, and he had acquired from the Russians, I believe, other types of biologicals, you know, like the sarin and the tabin gas. They were stored at the Qamasiya facility in Iraq.
Uh-huh.
And the sarin is a trimethyl ethyl thiocholine-based neurotoxin. And when our forward observer teams and stuff went in there, they were sniffing. They had all their sniffers and their chemical gear on. It turned out that some of the crates in that Qamasiya depot, it's a huge depot, they were actually marked with U.S. markings. And so they wanted to destroy that evidence to cover up that we had given him
supplied
all these covert arms. So they detonated that, and they didn't put it out on the radio. It was a covert thing where they just went in and said, look, we got to get rid of this evidence. They detonated all that stuff, and it made a big plume of air. It blew miles.
I remember.
Our troops that were downstream, they breathe that stuff too. So this whole area, Jeff and Ole, it was just this big toxic soup. And the guys came home, they labeled it Gulf War Syndrome. The records were put in the Murrah Building, and it was detonated, you know, just before the big hearing. So that was the main cover up. That's the reason the American people haven't been told this stuff. We armed Saddam Hussein covertly. Another way we armed him was with the Hawkeye 123 cluster bombs. CIA copied our patents on those, and they covertly took them down to a place in Argentina, and they hired a front company to begin building them and sending them to Saddam to arm him. And there was a component in them called zirconium. It's one of the key components, and it's on the State Department's banned export list. So they had to fake a bunch of files through the Agriculture Department and get the zirconium out of our mines down there to them too. So that was another covert arms thing that they used. So there was all this covert black ops, shadow government stuff going on that none of our people were told. And that's why I wrote this book, is to try to get the truth out to the American people and our veterans. My father was at Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 41, Guadalcanal and all that. He's actually my stepdad. He wasn't my father. But all our troops and all our guys are suffering while all these politicians get rich off these wars. And the story about what really happened in Benghazi, I have people that were right there on the ground, CIA assets. That's an amazing story. They told me right to my ear. But
Cody, excuse me, I would like you to come back on the program again very soon, and as many times as we need to get what you know out there. This is vital, absolutely vital information that we have a right to, we need to know. And I really honor you for doing this. This is extraordinary.
Yeah, Jeff, I'm sorry I talk so fast. I'm trying to jam a lot of
No,
stuff.
You're doing just great.
And,
don't, no,
and Ole, Ole's been silent, and Ole knows a lot more than me about some of this stuff. And
he's a wizard.
He's a wizard, that's for sure. But I really appreciate this time to talk about all
Well, this is absolutely crucial, what you have shared with us. Oh, let me, may I say one thing? I didn't know that in the Iran-Iraq war, I didn't know the Iranians had a 10-to-1 advantage in terms of foot soldiers on the ground. That's an extraordinary advantage, and yet the war was essentially fought to a stalemate. How did Saddam do it if he didn't use the anthrax?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, Jeff. You recall Donald Rumsfeld was the Secretary of Defense at that time.
Yeah.
And he was sent over there, and he met with Saddam. A lot of people don't know that Saddam was a paid asset. He was in the Ba'ath Party or a previous and had been tried to assassinate Mossadegh, the predecessor, and failed. And then he stayed out of the country a while, and then they finally he got power in the Ba'ath Party. And we were supporting Saddam with satellite information against the Iranian satellite intel. And he gassed the Kurds up there with some stuff to keep them at bay. And they had all that Muslim and the Shiite stuff, fundamentalism going on. It's been feuding for centuries there. But the Iranians had a much bigger country. They had a much bigger infantry. And we were worried that they would overrun Saddam, and they did have a 10-to-1 advantage. Hence, the Hawkeye 123 cluster bomb, that's the most efficient killing device, you know, non-NBC device, from air to ground to kill large numbers of troops. It spreads out, you know, small projectiles and kills a lot. That's why we secretly made those in that op down there in Argentina. And then later on, we gave him the anthrax from Fort Detrick. And but they had fought that war pretty good, and they had our satellite intelligence, and it kind of went to a stalemate. And so once that was done, Saddam regrouped and built up his military more and got it all ready, and then he decided to go into Kuwait, and that really. The Saudis were worried that if he went from Kuwait into their country, it would highly disrupt all the oil business and the oil markets and OPEC's price scheming and their ceaseless scheming. And so they put a lot of pressure on Bush and all of them to do something about Saddam. And so that's how all that stuff led.
Once again, we're back to the Saudis. And ultimately, the Zionists behind them. That's it. It always leads to the same place. Extraordinary material. Absolutely amazing. Saddam Hussein was an asset of ours for decades, I guess, ultimately. Not a stupid man. I wrote one of the first books on AIDS, published it in 90 or 91. And a friend of mine somehow knew Saddam Hussein. This is a funny little story. And she was going over there, and I said, here, take this book and give it to him. And she took one of my books over. And when she came back, it must have been 6 months later, she said, thank you. I gave him the book. He read it, and he said, tell him nothing about the Americans would surprise me. Because the gist of the book was HIV was a created organism. It was man-made. And that's what it was. He said, nothing about the Americans would surprise me.
Yep. So, they didn't answer that stuff.
Yeah. Okay. Now, the Gulf War itself. Let me spend just two, 3 minutes on that. We went in there, and from all intents and purposes, or for all intents and purposes, it seemed like it was pretty much a cakewalk. Now, I've heard stories that there was a lot of bribery of Saddam's top general staff to turn them against him and prevent full engagement army to army. Any truth to that, Cody?
I don't have any actual intelligence on that particular thing, but I did talk to some CIA assets that were involved with the looting of the presidential palace there in Baghdad. You know, Jeff, they had a lot of, Saddam had collected a lot of priceless historical things, you know, museum pieces and all, and those were removed and vanished off in the black hole, you know, before Baghdad was hit with that shock and awe thing. So I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay. Well, it was one that, I mean, this government's in the habit of flying a lot of money, a lot of places, and that was the word that they paid off some of the top generals. Who knows?
Yeah, and there were some other things going on over Baghdad that I don't know. Some people talk about geoengineering now and the chemtrails where they crisscross the sky and the planes are spraying. But over there in January of 91, we had civilian aircraft fly over Baghdad and stuff. They were spraying a nano-aluminum type of particulate. And what it did was it saturated the atmosphere. It had a slight magnetic electric charge, each particle, and it changed the overall electrical nature of the atmosphere, which made our radar systems on our Hellfire missiles and telemetry systems on the missiles all work more efficiently.
Well, there you go. And if you folks remember all the years we've been talking about chemtrails here, the application of putting metals in the atmosphere up there is enormous. It's a very broad potential to increase and enhance the defense capabilities and offensive capabilities, not to mention mass mind control. I mean, they this stuff up there. They're doing all kinds of different things.
Yeah, and the nano-aluminum, that's another toxin besides the uranium and all the other stuff. And so our guys are all getting sick. And so, yeah, anyway, that's the reason they bombed the Murrah building. And then there was a big cover-up with McVeigh later, and he was sent to the 10th Circuit Court up in Denver, and he was sent in front of Judge Richard Mache. And meanwhile, there was me who had operational knowledge of that, and the ATF-DEA had begun an undercover operation in 1997 in Colorado Springs called Operation Stingray. And I had met undercover agent, ATF agent Blake L. Butler. He was at the Waco Branch Davidian compound. He was also at Ruby Ridge. He was also supposed to be working at the Murrah building on April 19th, 95 when it was detonated, but called in sick. And so I met Agent Butler in an undercover fashion, and I sold him some legal guns. And then on April 22nd, 1999, 2 days after the Columbine High School shooting, it was the worst shooting in U.S. history, Bill Clinton and Janet Reno came up here, and they were talking on the TV, and I was sitting around with Blake Butler. I did not know they had undercover 4mm cameras, and he asked me what I thought about them. So I made the mistake of blabbing my mouth about all these CIA ops in Arkansas with Bill Clinton, how they were pedophiles. I talked to Kathy O'Brien, the CIA sex slave, blah, 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 and they recorded it all.
Whoops.
So then they planted me with evidence, okay, and threw me in prison. And the judge that they threw me in front of was Judge Edward Nottingham in the 10th Circuit, and he was nominated to his position by ex-director Central Intelligence George Bush. Now, the United States attorney in the 10th Circuit was none other than Tom Strickland, appointed by Bill Clinton. When Clinton first got into office, he fired every U.S. attorney and put his own guys in there because he knew what they'd been doing in Arkansas with all these drugs and arms, and so he was stacking the justice system. He was the first president to ever do that. And so they ramrodded me through there. And then there was another guy named Kerry James Gagan. And he had taken, he was a CIA asset like me. And he had been given a bunch of C4 plastic explosives to drive from Denver down to some contacts in Trinidad. When he got down there, there were three guys that were Middle Eastern guys. And he saw in English they were plans of the Murrah building. So he got spooked. he thought he was going to get set up as a patsy, and he drove back to the Secret Service office there in Denver. And he told them the CIA found out about it. They planted his house. They planted him with evidence, and they threw him in there with us. And so I was in there, three cells from McVeigh, with Kerry, James Gagan. They had all three of us that had operational knowledge about the Murrah building right there. Now, meanwhile, Tom Strickland had been in a law firm with Brownstein, Hyatt, and Faber. And turns out Norman Brownstein in Denver, he had once been on the Council of Six. Okay? They were the attorneys for the CIA back in the 70s when Bush was there. So this whole thing starts coming together. Now, they executed Timothy McVeigh on June the 11th, 2001.
Kerry Kerry. Cody, he's gone. McVeigh, people still talk. They say, nah, they didn't really kill him. The newswoman said that she saw the sheet still breathing. Cody, did they kill him or not?
I'm going to tell you what I know, and this has never been out in public before. When they took him, I was there that day. They took him out of there. And then he had to sit on death row. They went to the FCI, that's a Federal Correctional Institute in Terre Haute, Indiana, where they had the new death chamber. And so he was there and got executed. Now, about 2 weeks after that, I was in the FDC, the Federal Detention Center in Englewood, Colorado, in Denver, and my one of my cellmates was Chris Holsinger, and Chris Holsinger had an attorney and named Nathan Chambers, and Nathan Chambers was the last attorney on the McVeigh case. They changed attorneys several times. Well, Nathan Chambers had went to the execution chamber and held Timothy McVeigh's mother's hand on the front row, and they watched him get the shots through the glass.
Right.
Okay. Now, 2 weeks later, I was in the FDC legal visit room, and I walked up and approached Nathan Chambers, and I said, hey, are you McVeigh's attorney? And he said, I was. And I said, well, did you go to that execution? And he said, yeah, I was sitting on the front row holding his mother's hand. And I said, what was it like? And he turned his palm out to me, and he covered his face, and he put his head down, closed his eyes, and he shook his head, no, and he just turned around and walked out of the room. So what he witnessed was evidently something very bad. And like I said, I wasn't there, and I did not see it. I've heard stories that, you know, they gave McVeigh sugar water and all this stuff, and they didn't really kill him. I don't know. I don't have any actionable intelligence except.
That's a very interesting gesture he made. What's your best guess?
Well, my best guess, I was there with him. He was upset, very upset.
Uh-huh.
I don't think he was a civilian attorney, and he'd probably not been in the military, never seen a lot of people killed or anything. And most people who would sit and watch something like that, that's got to be ugly and horrible. Plus, holding the mother's hand while her son got killed.
No, it's
ugly.
Emotionally way over the top. Yeah.
So Nathan believed, I think, that he was killed there. Mm-hmm. So that's all I know. That's all I know.
I wonder how much they paid Tim McVeigh.
Well, I don't know that, but I will tell you this: when McVeigh got back, a lot of people don't know this. It's all in the book. When he got back from Desert Storm, he was very. He just got back from the war, and so he went to Fort Benning and signed up to join the Special Forces. Mm-hmm. And there was over 100 guys in his class, and they gave this standard psychological battery of tests and stuff. And so they were sitting around one day, and the CIA, the commanders pulled them out, and they took 10 of them. And the CIA approached McVeigh, and they wanted him to use the Special Forces as a front and be an agent for them. And he was to bomb buildings and assassinate and move drugs. And McVeigh was a patriot. And he said, no, I don't want to do that. And he quit the Special Forces. And after that, he went up to Calspan in Buffalo, New York, as a security guard. And during the Desert Storm, when he got his standard shots, now we're back to all the shots and the anthrax shots and the squalene, there was a covert program which was testing implantable microchips that the Pentagon didn't tell anyone. And this test was to test these chips in a real-time battlefield condition. And so McVeigh was given a microchip without his knowledge. And he went over there to Desert Storm, and Lockheed Martin had these satellites. They were the Battle Engagement Area Tracker System, the BEAST system. And they were tasked with observing soldiers and the microchips and how they worked in real-time battlefield conditions with dust and soot and so forth. And so when McGay got back, the protein coat on his chip failed, and he got sores on his butt, and he had it removed, and he got angry that the Army had actually done that to him. So he wrote letters to his sister Jennifer, and I have copies of them. Because Jennifer, later on, when he was charged with the bombing of the Murrah building,
yeah.
The FBI took all this stuff. So most people have never seen it, but I got the actual, I don't have the actual ones, but I got copies of the actual letters. Yeah. And McVeigh, you know, he complained to his sister that he'd been given.
He was furious. Oh, yeah.
He was furious.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that the CIA had wanted him to use the special forces and do all this bad stuff, and he quit it all. So he went to Calspan, and that was a big, big military contractor. They were into microchips. They were in the Redstone Air Force program with telemetry and electronic countermeasure systems and all that stuff. And I think it was there that he was approached with the job, you know, for that.
Uh-huh.
And also what a lot of people don't know about McVeigh, I had a friend named Ron Cole that was at the Branch Davidian compound. And he was a really good friends with David Koresh.
Uh-huh.
And his mother got sick. And he went to Florida to take care of his mother. And the very next day, the shootout at the Branch Davidian compound happened. So Ron flew back. By that time, they'd set up a perimeter. And so all the Branch Davidians that were not in the compound, they were outside watching. They set up tents, and they're watching this every night. And so around the compound at night, there were these black choppers with no markings. They were 204 Hueys, not Blackhawks.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw streaks going down to the roof, and they were the standard tracer rounds. But these civilians didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And so they said, "We wish we had some night vision." And some guy showed up, and he goes, "I've got some night vision from the Army." And so they sat and watched it all, and they asked him what his name was. And he said, "I'm Timothy McVeigh." And
I'll
so they watched. They watched them machine gun up that thing at night. And here's why they did it, Jeff and Ole. That's a standard Delta Force tactic. When you're surrounding a building and there's insurgents in the building, you always deny the higher levels of the floors. Okay, so they have to go down low.
Drive them down, yeah,
and then that you can collapse the perimeter closer to the building.
I got you.
If the snipers are up high on top, they can shoot further.
Mm-hmm.
So you take out the top, and then you collapse the perimeter. And so what happened there was, night after night, they watched this.
Were these machine guns suppressed, silenced?
No. They were probably standard M60s.
Uh-huh.
On the side, and every fourth round's a tracer in the belt.
Got it. Okay.
So, yeah, they were seeing the standard.
So we didn't hear about any of this, of course, on the outside.
No. This is all covered up because the feds had to conceal the fact, just like the Oklahoma City bombing, just like all the stuff Ole's talking about. It's the same pattern over and over with these ops. So they had murdered most of the Branch Davidians, and they were down on the lower floors. And after 54 days, you know, of that situation, they burned the building down to cover up the crimes.
Yeah, they had killed a lot of them before.
Yeah, and that was the fire that happened on April 19th, 1993. That was 54 dead, 21 children dead. So.
When you come back next time, Cody, I want to go into this a little bit more about the ATF agents, DATF, and when a couple of them got shot, and they were involved with Clinton's helicopter or something?
No, they were the bodyguards for Clinton.
His bodyguards, that's it. I knew they were somewhere around Clinton.
And the theory was that they'd seen some of his sex crimes being a bodyguard because they were close to him.
Easy to get rid of them.
To go over there and be the first ones to go in there, put them in harm's way. See?
Wow. All right, we'll cover this. Let me give everyone Cody's email. Just how much is the book, Cody, the few copies you have available? What do they cost?
We're telling people, you know, like $15 for the CD. And it's an edit copy of the book. The final edition will be coming out at some point. But the reason we did it this way, Jeff, was we were trying to get this information out in case something happened to me.
Understood. Well, it's out now, Cody, believe it. And I'm going to try, if you're available tomorrow night, I'm going to try and shift my schedule around. I'd like to get you to come back tomorrow and pick up loose ends and tie this again and together. This is a huge story, and I want to extend to you not only my thanks, but the thanks from God knows how many people listening all around the world right now who really, truly appreciate the risk you've taken and the service that you're giving right now to liberty and all of us who care about freedom. This is a big deal, and I thank you.
We're all working together to try to expose this ugliness, this shadow government stuff, and hopefully stop it to make our world better.
Well, we're doing our best, and that's all we can do. It's a hell of an enemy, I'll tell you that, and you know it far better than I ever would, could, or should. Talk to you soon, Cody. Thank you very much. I'll talk to you soon. All right. Cody's email, I guess, I should repeat it again for all of you who might want to get this book, $15. Cody Golden Elk, CODY Golden Elk at yahoo.com.